Welcome to the Historics Podcast, and it's finally time to decide what is the best GTI ever made. Probably something Tom might have to decide upon later. Stick around, you won't want to miss this.
Buying or selling a classic car? Head to historics.co.uk or click below for a free valuation.
Now, before we get started, make sure you hit the like and subscribe button. The really important one is the subscribe button, because we see how many people watch these, but only a few of you subscribe. So make sure you subscribe, and it's super, super helpful. It takes 2 seconds and it's absolutely free. So thank you very much.
You subscribe, we keep filming.
Maybe that'll put them off.
Yeah, maybe get some better guests.
Not hard over here, sorry.
Right, straight in. Best GTIs ever made. Now, obviously, a bit of a contentious thing. If you go on Google, Volkswagen virtually locked this down. But there were other GTIs. Yep. So, first out, what does GTI actually stand for?
I'm going to show myself up once again as not
generally
a car person,
technically important.
So, it was created originally by Maserati, and it was on their 1960 3500 GTI. And the actual wording in Italian, here we go, this is where I'm going to make a real fool of myself.
Turismo.
Italian,
Grande
stop
Turismo Inizione.
Inizione.
Which obviously just means Gran Turismo.
Grand Touring.
Grand Touring, sort of say, injection. Nothing too spectacular. But it was then formed by those. And I think probably the next time it really, really took hold was, of course, the Mark 1 GTI, which started the
People
entire
forget
evolution.
That the first one actually came out in 1973. And actually then production would start in Germany in 1974. Now, that's really geeky.
And it was a bit...
That is really geeky.
Did you know, it was a bit of a bitzer. So it was actually a fair weight of Audi parts in it. It was a bit of a thrown together. It was designed and it was, you know, revolutionary. Well, but like all things like that, it was actually sort of put together.
Luckily it stayed in Germany then.
Well, yes. It was a bit like the first Porsche. Same sort of thing, wasn't it? It was part Beetle, part everything put together to make the first car, the 356, and then suddenly rolled on from there.
Well, back in those days, there was a certain German head of the game who probably, if they did get it wrong, probably wouldn't last very long.
Moving on that one. Okay, so what we're going to do here is we're going to pick out a couple each, and we'll talk through all of the GTIs that you could own. Obviously, the golden era is probably late 80s, early 90s, but of course, they're still making GTIs today.
Yep.
So, James, first out of the pot, what GTI do you remember hooning around in when you were young?
As company cars, even then, I had a GTI, which is a 16-valve GTI in the 80s in London, like every estate agent yuppie. I was one. So we had one of those, which was green, which was great. We loved those. That was the, you know, the one that everybody wanted at the time. And then in the early 90s, I had a 1.9 GTI Peugeot.
Did you?
Which was, honestly, it was like a bean can with a V8 in it.
Both as company cars?
Yes, and they were fantastic. The one with the 1.9, my boss at the time was an ex-rally driver. He had one, I had one, and we used to drift them around Clapham Common in our spare time in the afternoons.
Did you sell any houses?
Yeah, quite a few. But it was they were both fantastic in their own right. Peugeot, obviously, very light.
Yep.
The Golf, not so light, but great fun. It was a very solid car.
Do you remember driving the Golf? Because having driven them now, later in years, when we've all got more modern power steering and such, the Golf does feel heavier, certainly, than the Peugeot, which, of course, was an era later, because the next car
much
was
much more cumbersome. The Peugeot had no power steering. You didn't need it. It was so light. Even in London, you know, parking it, whatever, it was very easy. But the power, I mean, you could spin front wheels in, obviously, first, but second, third, and fourth, just about.
Yep.
It was terrific.
On
your
way to your appointments. So which one would you favour out of the Golf?
No, I'd have the Peugeot.
You'd have the Peugeot.
Definitely.
So the Peugeot,
much more fun.
205.
Not probably quite so good in the head-on. I think the Golf will come out better. But I do think that Peugeot really, even in today's standards, I think, you know, it would give a lot of modern cars a good run for their money.
Okay.
100%.
Okay, so Tom, what have you got up there on that list of GTIs?
I actually used to own a Mark 7.5 Golf GTI. So
did you? Right up there, yeah.
Completely down the other end of the spectrum, really. I loved it just as a kind of daily driver that was a laugh and just absolutely bulletproof. Loved that car. But I remember when I was younger, when I first started learning to drive and kind of looking at hot hatches and loads of things I couldn't insure.
Yes.
You had like the Saxo VTS and stuff. But I did want a 205 1.9 GTI. Mm-hmm. That was the golden goose. But they were crazy money then. They're absolutely mental.
Tom,
money
I think
now.
You hit the nail on the head. They're good fun.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what they were built for.
That's exactly, yeah. You know,
actually, the I remember, and I always remember it's so cool. Actually, our music teacher, so I would have been, you know, 15. The music teacher was the coolest teacher in school, drove a black 1.9 GTI. And it was that sort of thing of like everyone else was driving in bigger cars, and he just turned up in this sports car, this little sports car. And I just remember thinking, what a great... But the problem back then was you couldn't blooming well insure the things. I mean,
it was a nightmare. Yeah,
he would have been in his 40s then. He'd probably been okay. But anyone in that 1920, you aspired to them, but you couldn't insure them.
Yes, thousands. Often the insurance would be sort of multiples of the price of the car.
Yeah, which got worse and worse and worse throughout the 90s.
Yep.
Which probably the golden was that late 80s car before they cottoned on. So... Yeah. You also fondly remember that. What other GTIs have you?
I wanted a Lupo GTI, a VW Lupo GTI. Yeah. There was a big trend of sort of getting those and then putting sort of 993 Porsche wheels on them and stuff and all that kind of
the Lupos, the ups. They're sort of more of the. They hunker back to that original
two door,
that lighter.
The little Lupo thing with a little kind of frog eye light to kind of look like a mashed Beetle and Polo.
In Farnham, Granny would have that. But in London, something else.
Not the Lupo GTI. They're rare as hell. I saw one the other day and I got very excited. Yeah, I don't think many of them made it. I think they got owned by people that are a bit too exuberant on the road and they most of them end up around a tree somewhere. So yeah, I still actually really want one of those. Yeah, really good fun. And that's exactly it. And any hot hatch these days is 80 supercar level of performance, if not faster. You know, you look at your Golf R's or even the Golf GTI these days, you put your foot down, you're doing 70 and a 30 before you even think about it. But back then you could wring its neck, you get through the first few gears and you'd probably be somewhere near the speed limit.
Well, there was the original fun, wasn't it? Because actually you could genuinely wring its neck, whereas you can't wring the neck. You can, but only if you're really, really steaming along.
TDI Golf, you could still give it a good thrashing.
Well, yeah, because you run out. But
what?
But I always found that whenever you had the cars with... I had a 1.1 Fiesta, I've said it before. You used to literally on the red line the whole time, trying to find everything, never use the brakes. But I think you could do that with the old 80s, 90s GTIs as you move forward. And I like about the Lupos, the ups, and those sort of more modern incarnations is that they're smaller cars now, but actually if you park them next to each other, that's exactly the size they used to be.
Yeah.
And they're all about a small, powerful little engine, 150 brake horsepower, not much more.
No.
And then that way, then... It's all about being light, less passengers,
turbo,
and throwing it around, which is where all the fun comes from, isn't it?
Yeah.
See, when I was looking back through a lot of these, and naturally, like you, straight into the 205 GTI, and always remember the Golf GTI. But I also remember when my dad's company car, I had a Citroen, I think it was a BX at the time.
Yeah.
And then I remember always wanting your dad would always come home with a basic example. He's like, "Dad, why haven't you got the GTI?" Not realizing that it's not that easy.
Yeah.
All the benefit in kind or whatever. You're just basically
there's a CX
GTI.
Yeah, it's light, and to sit in one, if you've never sat in one, honestly, it's like your grandmother's armchair. It's so comfortable.
But what I liked about the Citroens is that they were almost trying to make spaceships. They almost thought they saw the future. This is what we're going to make it like. Mm. Missed by a country mile, but in a sort of true French terms, it was just bonkers. And, you know, then throw a turbo on it, a 1.6 engine, again, gets that sort of magic 150
brake horsepower. Suspension was terrific. Road holding, not bad. A bit wallowy.
I wouldn't say they're the prettiest cars, and they're probably not the most collectible, but if you had a stunning example sat there with, you know, literally maintained from that last auction we had one.
Yeah.
To me, it would be more interesting than what I have seen lots of now, which is with the Golf GTIs. Mm. We're starting to see now the Mark II Golf GTIs, the big bumper 16 valves, which, of course, were known for being bulbous and heavier, but were really, really popular. And I think so the same iconic. Thing. Yeah, so iconic. And probably a better car, just a bit heavier.
Well, you've had electric windows.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, that was
a plus. Yeah, but it was a luxury in those days.
So what else have you thought that you can imagine? What other GTIs could really be punching up there with what is inevitably a 205 and Golf sort of head-to-head?
Well, Suzuki must have done an equivalent, I suppose.
They did a Suzuki Swift.
Swift GTI. Yep.
Which... 100 brake horsepower, 0-60, I think was about 9 seconds, made out of a crisp packet.
And there's Chuck used to hill climb one.
Really?
Yeah. And this thing arrived and he had it completely... had it all decked out with roll cage and everything else. And he and his wife used to tip up to Shelsey Walsh. And we used to sit there and we think, here he comes. And he used to drive fabulous single-seaters back in the 70s with V8s in Land Rover and then Cosworth and so on. And in his latter days, a bit older, He had a Suzuki Swift. But he'd had it all tweaked. It sat on the line, looking as though he was about to tip up at Waitrose, and this thing flew off the line. So, oh, right, okay. But it had a suspension loaded tight. It was amazing.
I sort of deliberately looked for it, as many GTIs as I could find, and there was almost all of them were sort of in that, as I say, that era between 85 and 95. It did keep going, though. I mean, even down to the Nissan Pulsar GTI.
I wanted one of those so much.
And that was massively rapid. I mean, that was, I think, 250 or so brake horsepower, four-wheel drive Subaru Impreza Solus territory.
Didn't weigh anything.
And it was horrifically ugly, but really, really quick. Mm. And then even, I think, with Peugeot, because one of my favourites, and still to this day, my favourites is the 306 GTI6. It was actually not that powerful. It was about 150, 160 brake horsepower on what was a bigger car.
I haven't seen one of those literally since I was a kid.
I had a look.
It just reminded me of those.
I don't think they were ever as popular, but they were still a good car.
But they were actually really understated, and they were really good to drive. A bit like the 205.
Didn't they come in that awful colour?
They're that bronzy colour.
Yeah. I think that's what put a lot of people off. But I love that now.
Like the Renault Fuego. You remember that? How many of those you ever see?
I don't even know.
There's no match on a GTI. It was a bloody awful
car. But you imagine 10 years' time, when maybe even less than that, we start to looking for these sort of 90s hot hatches.
Yeah.
I can't remember the last time I saw a GTI 6. I really cannot remember. And a lot of them would have been, I'm sure, written off, scrapped, thrown away. So finding one that's in particularly good condition... Well, there's plenty of 205 GTIs and Golf GTIs about, but I don't remember seeing things like
that. Probably even drive it to the scrapyard.
Well, it's a French car. I mean, they don't last forever. So we've got Citroëns, Peugeots, the Volkswagen, Toyota Corolla GTIs. We've got... There's all sorts out there.
Astra GTEs.
Oh, see, but then you get really weird Corolla GSIs, GTI. I mean, basically, that GTI formed a number of different variants of ways of saying sporty. Prerequisites, you think, on a GTI. It's got to have probably 100 brake horsepower at least.
Yeah.
Even in that era. At least 100 brake horsepower. It's got to be realistically three-door, hasn't it?
Ultimately, three-door.
I mean, if you put five in it, suddenly you're just sort of...
You've got to have the sport seats. Yeah. You know, you've got to have a few...
It's got to be manual.
Definitely.
So, your favourite?
Has to be the Golf.
Golf.
Sadly.
You've gone to Golf,
I have changed my mind.
Golf Mark 1.
I think because... I think the road holding is better. They're more solid. I think the trouble is with that Peugeot is that unless it's a dry day and you hoof it, you know, you're going to be in lots of trouble. And if I would wrap it around something, I'd rather wrap a Golf and come out.
I love this. So the reason you're choosing the Golf,
I've had a second think about it. If I have my childhood again or my youth again, I think,
okay,
I'd
so
go for the Golf.
Golf, Mark 1, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
What would be your choice?
I actually... I drove a Mark 1 Golf GTI recently. My business partner actually bought the... Do you remember the green one
that was here? I do remember from here,
I drove it. I liked it. They say never meet your heroes. I wasn't... I think I was measuring it against unrealistic modern standards. I think I'd still go for a 205.
So 205.
1.9 GTI.
It's got to be
1.9. That was my hero car.
1.9, no sunroof.
No sunroof.
What colour?
Black.
We go black.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think... Sadly... I think I probably have to pick the best GTI of all time. I would go 205. It's like that Golf Mark 1 is always going to be iconic. It did start the whole thing. It was the reason that GTI really exists. But that first incarnation of the 205 just took it that little bit level further. They took all the ideals, made it a little bit. It's actually prettier as well.
Yeah.
Quicker. I think that probably over time, the pair of them are just as iconic, but I'd prefer to drive a 1.9. 1.6 would lose. I think it has to be the 1.9. It just gives that little...
But we're right.
Ironically, of the two, I think from auction prices, I had a quick look through, the most expensive Mark 1 sold to date that I could find was about £45,000.
Wow.
The most expensive 205 was €68,000.
Wow. Is that what they are?
Yeah. Well, this would have been a very low mileage. Beautiful car with lovely...
I know, but 60 odd grand for that.
Yeah, we only have to see what people really hunker
up for. What's an acceptable one in the UK?
Probably looking at late teens, I think, for an acceptable one.
Really? That's
because
the problem is they
get very dogged very quick if you don't have a good one, don't they? And people are starting to restore them. And then you'll start to see huge amounts of money on restorations to get them to where they want to be. But in all honesty,
Well, you know, if the mileage is slightly high, I mean, those cars were only built for one thing, weren't they?
Yeah. I mean,
so mileage is slightly high. You know that engine's had a tough life.
Yeah.
I mean, the rest of it may be fully rebuilt, shiny, won't they? And polished and new carpets, whatever.
And on that 205, of course, they had that same engine, I think, was in the 309 GTI, which no one bought. I mean, I can't remember seeing many of those from new. And even in the 405, I think, GTI, which was the big saloon car, I think was a similar variant of that engine. But again, you're right. If they're high mileage,
well, you hear about people restoring them, which is fine. They spend the money in the restoration, but I bet they don't take the engine out, strip it, rebuild it, put it back.
No.
No.
Probably cost about 50p to fix the engine anyway.
So we're set. Tom, deciding factor, best GTI ever.
A lot of pressure here. 205. 205. GTI 1.9. There we go. Don't know why I got the final say on that. Most ignorant at the table, but I'll have that. Thank you very much.
So on to other matters, motoring. Obviously, this podcast will come out just ahead of our Bicester auction. But we've just, those sitting here, just come out of Goodwood Week, which was last week.
Yep.
Which amazingly had the Saturday cancelled because of wind, high winds. Is that a first?
Yeah,
well, it is. And of course, it's not just to do with cars being blown off or motorcycles.
No, crate stands.
You've also got the trees, which most part of the hill climb, probably the last half of the section is tree-lined. Yep. And of course, danger with the trees, et cetera, et cetera.
And having been there, all of those trade stands on top of you.
I mean, temporary structures, I think, was there because they've got no way of vouching how well all those stands were together because obviously they're all third parties. So, and if they're told that there's high winds and something clobbers someone, their necks are going to be on the line instantly.
I've always thought that, I mean, I went to the very first one and I've been to many of them. And I've always thought that, you know, the race drivers are asked to go to the festival speed. They're there to race. They're not there to potter around because it's in their nature and their blood. So, they floor the cars from the start line to the finish. And the only thing between that car and the general public are hay bales. Now, one day, something will happen.
Well, they're going, these modern cars now, they're going so fast up that hill. Some of them, and they've got batteries under them, so they're weighing twice, three times the amount they ever used to.
Yeah.
And they're hitting God knows how
even on demonstrations, they are absolutely.
Some of these electric cars, they weigh tons, and they're absolutely pacing it up that
hill. They have Le Mans cars.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a big accident with one of the cars, which I saw came off the track, went through all the hay bales.
Yes.
And landed, excuse me, very close to the final barrier before the general public. They all scattered. Mm. And of course, the wheel fell off the Coombs Mark II Jaguar by one, a famous car. Okay, that happens. I mean, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, but
luckily, I mean, hit two members of public, but.
Yeah. How they got away with that, I don't know.
But there's a point where. We stay in everything, the excitement goes. I mean, don't get me wrong, yes, there are inherent risks, but I remember standing RAC rallies back in the 90s, and, you know, that was really sketchy. You'd be stood on the curb as the car would come past. There is, of course, a place for the safety, but it is motor racing, and you sign up for going in, and if you...
But I remember that, you know, the festival speed is not a competition.
No, it's much more a demonstration.
They are on that fine line between demonstration and competition. Of course they want to beat you going up the hill and have the fastest time of the day because you want that kudos. That is not a demonstration.
Yeah. No.
So
anything timed, that's why they tracked
it. I hope it doesn't change because, as you rightly say, Matt, it will change the configuration and the feeling to pick up Armco barriers, put up mesh to stop flying debris, et cetera, et cetera. It will change it. And that nobody wants.
I think the organisers are in a tough space now because they've had some near misses this year. If something happens next year and someone does get wiped out, instantly everyone will say, well, last year someone nearly died and you've done nothing and blah, blah, blah. And then their necks will be on the line. So even if the organisers don't want to put mesh up and put people up three miles away from everything,
and the moment
they might have to.
They changed part of it, the finishing line, sadly, some years ago, Jeffrey Dawson Damer, of course, famously, he actually had a heart attack as he was going towards the finishing line, veered off and hit the finishing post, killed the marshal and killed him.
Christ.
And that they changed that configuration there so that it was just a little bit of wood around a lovely great metal pole, which he hit, and that was it. And the marshal was hit as well. So they did change that configuration, but not massively in terms of health and safety, no.
I do think it's a wonder that in this day and age, both the Goodwood events, can still go ahead and you can still get that close to it and still get that feeling, because it would be a shame if you had
this. I hope they don't change it. But
I mean, the Formula One has to because of the sheer speeds and the competition, but you know, you are a way away from competition in Formula One now.
And all the hill climbs are like that. I mean, I've motorized all the hill climbs.
And they're all very, very robust.
There is nothing. No. You don't have Armcos. Well, there are Armcos in certain areas. Most of it is a bank or a tree. Well, frankly, if you hit it, you shouldn't have been there anyway. And if you hit it, you're generally going to come off worse than the general public. Yeah. But nevertheless, there is more probably at Goodwood in terms of bales than there are.
They're staked in as well, in fairness, I think. I think they are sort of plonked.
But it's... And this brings me to my next point, actually. Without these bastions of motor racing harking back to the past, whether it be Goodwood, Brooklands and so forth, and Goodwood doing it so well because of the competitive racing, you wouldn't have places like Bicester where we go as well, where people genuinely go there for that sort of feel of the nostalgia. Yeah. And it's a great location. We go there for the next auction in September. And I'm sure we'll be doing some filming up there, hopefully with Haggerty, who are our new insurance partners, and just set themselves up there a little base. But that is exactly why people want to go to these places. Yeah. They have that heart back to how it used to be. And you say the straw bales are Goodwood, and the fact that you see the racetracks and you feel it.
Well, it's the close proximity to the cars, the smell of the Castrol R, if you want to put it in your fuel tank. You know, everybody, and you can walk up, you can go and chat with all the past stars and present stars if you want to. And that has always been the attraction of the Festival of Speed. Whereas, you know, if you go to
The car park.
Well, the car park is a bit better than what you see at the track. There is the attraction. I mean, that is the event. That's what Lord March has created. Yeah. And uniquely.
So at Bicester, which is in September, we'll all be there, of course. Some cars will be
very
consigned.
Exciting.
By the time this podcast is out and you're watching our lovely faces, there will be some cars online, but there will still be some time to consign. So if you do have something, even for Bicester or for later in the Mercedes-Benz world, please do get in contact. Link will be in the bio below. You can call us or email us. So do get in contact, and we look forward to seeing you all there. Now, one last topic I wanted to do before we have a bit of fun was mileage. We spoke about it earlier with the modern GTIs, about the lower mileage, and I hate it. I really hate it. I hate that it's become, especially with modern cars, so much about mileage that the actual essence of the car has become secondary to the mileage on the clock. We all know that a car with negligible mileage is going to be a poor car to run, to own. And my question is to you, if you had the option of buying a car with 2,500 miles on the clock, with 50,000 miles on the clock, or 100,000 miles on the clock, the 5,000-mile car never driven, the 50,000-mile car has been used robustly, average mileage, average history, or the 100,000-mile car has one owner, an absolutely impeccable history, and is beautiful. Mm. Which one do you end up pitching for, and why?
Okay, first on this one. You want?
Go on, Tom.
It depends why you're buying the car. If you're buying one just to keep running to the floor, use every day, cherish, and just that's it, till death do you part, probably the 100,000-mile car. If you're buying something as an occasional, polish it up, take it out on weekends, and potentially think, at some point I might need to sell this to pay for my kids' school fees or something like that, and value retention is a thing, but you do still want to get some use out of it, it's going to be the 50,000-mile car. But if you want something that you just think, I'm going to buy this, sit on it for 10 years, I don't want to drive the bloody thing, it'll be the 2,000-mile car, I think. Because you know the value retention is going to be best than the low-mileage car,
even though that
might be illogical. I get what you say.
That's the point, isn't it? Because, so, for instance, these E-types, Pagodas, we're sat surrounded by beautiful older cars. Mm. Mileage is not important, is it? It's the condition, usually when they're restored. Mm. And I do wonder, with these modern cars, we obsess about the mileage to the point where they'll get to an age where, actually, the mileage doesn't actually mean much anymore. We've had some old classic cars, 60s cars, where it's got very, very low mileage, but actually it's nowhere near the cachet that it would have been if it was 20 years old.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, well, actually, to me, just, you know, again, I understand the value. Everyone's obsessed with the value. And
I think
it's become
a very contentious question concerning classic cars and the mileage. I do, because if you were to buy a Rolls-Royce Silver Ghost, who cares what the mileage is?
Exactly.
It doesn't, who cares?
It's
it
not displayed
matter.
On the outside, is
How
it?
How many times do you think that Phantom 1, 1929 Phantom 1, fabulous looking car, how many times has that engine been rebuilt? So if that's gone over the clock twice, three times, who cares? If you have a Ferrari Boxer, I know of a 512 BBI Boxer that has a full Class E, has done 211 miles from new.
That's
now, you either buy it, store it, put a duvet on it and forget it, or drive it like a modern old classic. What are you going to do? Now, it depends why you want to buy your asset.
Yep.
At the moment in the UK, luckily, the asset that we're all sitting around are tax-free on capital growth. So sit on it and wait, flog it, keep as a pension pot or whatever you want to do, and you don't pay any tax on it.
Yep. What I can't get my head around, though, is the idea of buying it and not using it. Because to me, isn't art or antiques or something like that more useful if you're not using it? A car is to be used.
I think some of these are art, though. I would argue that some of the designs around us, they are movable art. They're art grade. Not everything, but some of these icons, like an F40, yeah, it's fun to drive, but actually that'd look equally as good as a feature just stuffed in your house. I know it's sacrilegious not to drive it and whatever, but I think some of these cars are art grade. Even something like the Testarossa, arguably terrible to drive. I mean, absolutely unbelievable to look at.
Possibly better as art.
And a lot of collections, you know, they don't run them.
Yeah.
I mean, these old cars do have to be run. You know, they're like a human. You need feeding, you need drinking, you need food, you need to keep them going.
Yeah.
You know, whereas collections like the Donington collection, they do actually run those.
Yeah.
Frequently, they take them out for displays or whatever, but they do run them. Other Bewley, for instance, most of those cars don't run.
Yeah,
they go in there, plonk, and they're left there.
You're all just perishing and everything.
The Haynes Motor Museum. If anyone's ever been there, it's great. Most of those cars, which you know, old man Haynes bought them originally, they've sat there and not moved 20, 30, 40 years.
Yeah, so they're screwed then. They basically
you need to take them and completely redo them to get them on the road again.
Yeah.
So it depends why you want to buy them. It goes back to that original question.
Yeah, and I think
does it matter? Depends on your asset and what you want to do with that asset and why you bought it in the first place on a 5-year program, 10-year, 15-year.
Do you think, though, and this is a question for you, working in auctions as we have done for the last decade and longer, has it become more asset-driven and less enthusiast-driven?
I think it will become more asset-driven as the petrol and diesel cars get phased out. The electric car will come in, probably not in my lifetime, totally, but eventually
you've only got a couple of years left.
They were rude. I think I do think that, and I think that they will become an asset. You will be able to move them around like a piece of art. You won't drive them on the road, but you'll be given a tractor at Silverstone, Brands Hatch, wherever else.
Yeah.
You can take your car there, thrash them all day if you like, all the fumes, lovely, and then put them on your trailer and take them home again.
One of the things I like about Mark's ethos on historics actually is it's always been very eclectic, and because we deal with cars from £5,000 up to sort of probably £500,000, a bit more, you do get to meet and deal with clients that are just enthusiasts that just want to buy a car, work on the car, drive the car, as well as many in here, they are sort of asset driven expensive purchases. So I do like that you get to meet people that actually they want to tinker with cars.
Yeah.
And that old, because I do feel, I worry actually that the next generation, my generation really, are less engaged with the car. The car has become less about the mechanicals, and thus there's less enthusiasm.
Well, you can't change a plug in a modern car. You can't change a light bulb.
And there was a lot of when you used
there's
to own an older car.
There's less inclination to learn you can't do anything.
I took out the new Ferrari 296 the other day.
Yeah.
Hybrid thingy, and I made that point in my video. I said, in 15 years' time, whilst the technology is fantastic now and it's working all brilliantly, and isn't it wonderful? It's cut into electric mode, it's silent in traffic, fantastic. In 15 years' time, that it's like imagine getting a laptop out from 15 years ago.
The example of cars,
or even a phone from six years ago.
Yes,
it's finished.
These things are, you know, they've got a lifespan now, and I think cars are going the same way.
Yeah,
you know, they're not designed. There are a few. You're right, the Ferraris.
You open it up and there's just panels of circuit boards under everything, and you just think, if someone stops making the parts for these, you're absolutely screwed. Most of these old stuff, someone can make a part pretty much.
I like the idea sometimes of, like, you know, picking up an old MGB, and it's an old car to use. Some of the old vintage cars which people still work on, they're great fun, because part of the joy of it is it's the whole thing is an event, not just the drive, the warming up, the maintenance, everything's an event. So I'm hoping it doesn't die out completely. I'm hoping it doesn't all become
provided there are professionals within the classic car industry who can make, rebuild. They've got laser machines, computer driven.
Yeah.
You can make anything.
Yep.
Anything. Even if it's on, you know, the 3D machine or whatever it is.
Yep.
You can make anything for an E-Type or whatever it is. The modern cars, how'd you do that?
Forget it.
How'd you do that?
Forget it.
How do you make a part for a Tesla?
Yeah.
3D printer.
You can't go to Bicester Heritage and say, excuse me, Rodney, could you make something for that Tesla? it won't work.
It's not a thing. I mean, I'm not going to say what I drove here in today.
A Tesla.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an appliance.
In 20 years' time,
I think we're seeing
it is like a kettle.
Yeah. I think we're seeing a fork in the road where we are just having cars that are appliances, like the electric cars. They are just appliances. You run them on a lease and then just hand them back, and wherever they go, they go, which is the opposite of sustainable. Yep. That's another argument. And you'll see the enthusiast market, which are sort of weekend cars. And
gotta love Elon, then.
I honestly couldn't care less. It's just a cheap lease.
I'm joking.
I'll wrap this up. So I always thought that the best way, full circle, was to electric cars to become a bit like older cars, whereby you'd have a chassis and then you'd have a body. And you could have just had the battery chassis and then just interchange the bodies. And then suddenly it does become much more renewable. But unfortunately, the batteries are the bits that are moving faster in technology than everything else.
What do they do with the old batteries?
I
think we'll get into lithium theft at some point as well. I think people start nicking electric cars for the lithium as lithium goes up. One final thing on the topic of kind of mileage. Owners, amount of previous owners. I've always been of the opinion lots of owners isn't a bad thing, because every time you buy a car, you get it checked out.
They get it serviced.
You get it checked out, you get it looked at, you get it inspected and blah, blah, blah. And you spend money. Whether you like it or not, you spend money within the first month. You do all sorts of bits and bobs, right? And before you sell a car, what do you do?
Here's a top
tip. Spend money as well.
Here's a top tip. When you're looking at previous owners, look at the time in which those owners owned the car.
Yeah.
Because often what you see with previous owners, if a car's jumped around a lot in a very short distance of time, there's probably a reason for it.
Yeah, I get that.
Well, those 80s 911s, you should chop and change. Yes. They've ticked the box.
Yeah.
But if you look at, if they've had them for, I'd say probably 18 months, then you've done enough to do what you're ticking the box, and you would have maintained and looked after it at that point. If they've jumped around a little bit more, I'm a little bit nervous.
And the mileage has gone up with it. If it's got 10 owners and 200,000 miles, fantastic. If it's got 15 owners and, you know, 3,000 miles, you think, well, what on earth?
And you can also
here?
Get really overcomplicated, because obviously, you know, if you're looking at a car with 7 owners, which isn't a great deal, but there could be 3 within the first 2 months, you know, pre-registered first owner, second owner, and then also families can move them. So you're right, I think that the tip is really look into that history file, because it can, just looking at the number, can really divert you from the car.
I always look for tacky mods. So if someone's like put privacy film on the windows, or painted the wheels black, or coloured in like
the
letters,
chrome strip on the around.
Anything that says I'm not an enthusiast, I'm just a moron. I will try and avoid as like kind of a...
Is moron on the V5?
Unfortunately, it's not. No, you have to look for telltale signs.
Most of Tom's, yes.
It's actually in French, you say moron. It sounds a lot better, doesn't it?
Right, should we finish up the serious stuff?
Let's get on
to a bit of a GTI-themed quiz, of which I'm sure you'll both fail miserably.
Thank you.
Yeah.
But, okay, so I've got 7 questions, okay? Right. Most of them multiple choice. So you've got a shooting chance here.
Okay.
So the first one, and I've said a few of these things in earlier, so you might even get a really head.
I wasn't listening.
Okay, how many, this is an easy one, how many iterations of the Golf GTI has there been? Oh, come on, this is the easiest one of the quiz.
What are we on now? 9? 10? Or are you counting the 0.5s
as
well?
Here we go.
Mark 1,
7,
two,
8, or 9?
9.
God, no, it must be 9,
We're currently on 8.
No.
Sods.
I think the 9th was made last week.
It probably was. But you're waiting. Okay, number 2. How much brake horsepower did a 205 GTI 1.6 have? Was it 112 brake horsepower, 115 brake horsepower, or 121 horsepower?
115.
112.
James with 115, stealing the march. Was that just a guess, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so, and I'm not sure about this, blame Google or just write in the comments and slag me off if need be, but what was the most popular market for the original Mark 1 GTI?
Which country?
Yeah, which country?
Or which age group?
Which country?
Germany.
I'm
going to
say somewhere
niche
in Asia.
Somewhere niche in Asia. So, interestingly, according to one Google review I found, it was actually France, which might explain why the 205 GTI was made rapidly after.
Mm.
So, obviously, it was well received there, and the crazy French were sort of thinking, no, this is not good enough.
We can't let them win.
So, France, apparently. Now, again, if I'm wrong, write that in the comments, please. Nearest the pin, this one. Nice and easy. Mm-hmm. What is the 0 to 60 time for the Citroën BX GTI?
And what's the
nearest the pin? You can guess, and I'll see who's closest. So the Citroen BX, I can tell you it did 123 miles an hour. It was shaped like a slightly angular brick.
9.2
for James.
Nine dead.
Tom wins it. It's 8.9. Oh, do okay. The Citroen BX a disservice, the pair of
okay.
you. Okay, this is another one. How much, when new, we haven't spoken about this yet, was the Rover Metro GTI? Lord. Was it? Oh, it was in the 90, 95 brake horsepower, so I think it's slightly underpowered. Should have done 100. So was it £12,000? Was it £9,500? Or £7,000? For the mighty Rover GTI.
Seven.
Yeah, seven, but even that sounds like too much.
How many are still on the road?
It was actually 9,500.
Too much money.
Yeah.
No wonder
it
didn't last.
That sounds like a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But I don't know what a new Volkswagen Up GTI is, but I think it's probably an 11, 12, isn't it? So.
No, mate, everything's 30 grand these days.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, everything. Just doesn't matter that it's 30 grand. I think, I don't know.
What do you want, £30,000?
Yeah.
Okay, so according to How Many Left, the website that we all use to figure out how many are actually registered on the road, how many 306 GTI 6s are left on the UK, or sorry, were left on UK roads in 2022?
50.
Would you want me to give you a multiple choice on it?
Go on then.
So I've got three options. 250, 720, or 1,122.
250.
250, surely.
Yeah, I think I gave that away earlier. It's only 250 registered, of which a few
Does
of them
that make them
there.
Rare, or just the fact they're rubbish?
No, they're French, so they don't last.
You could argue
very
the
long.
Point.
Well, both.
at least their wine does.
Yeah. I reckon if you pick one up now, the gearbox and the engine's probably really good. The body's fallen off of it.
Yeah, like Alfa Soot.
Yes, exactly, like an old Alfa. Yeah. Okay, and the final question. We are 1-1. No, yes, 1-1 at the moment. You both got that question. 2-2, I suppose. How fast did the Golf GTI Mark 8 Club Sport, and what time did it lap the Nürburgring? Was it 8 minutes and 2 seconds, 7 minutes and 54 seconds, or 9 minutes and 52 seconds?
7:54.
Got it, 7:54.
Yes.
Really?
I know low sevens are like supercars and whatever. Under seven is like hypercars.
To put that in context, that's 1 second faster than a Ferrari F430.
I'd much rather not like a Ferrari.
Well, you're going to have to go. Well, probably because that Club Sport actually has a Nürburgring button setting. And it softens the dampness, but gives you all the beans because of riding the curbs.
That's very useful on the M3 at Fleet Services.
Well, actually, we've been talking about this when we've driven a couple of Ferraris and things this year.
Yeah.
Softening the dampers, but having the power is actually where you want.
Yeah.
Because none of our roads are
modern Ferraris enough. Have the bumpy road settings, so you can put it in all singing or dancing, gearbox, throttle response, blah, blah, but it actually slackens off. So on B roads, the car actually is still on the floor for a lot of the time, which is
great. Difference because you can generally use power and not lose your back.
Do you get a speed camera aware machine with that?
That you don't know, I'm afraid. With your license,
put Waze on.
You'd be in trouble.
My license, I think. Yeah.
We can't bring that up on camera because you're
speeding
in public.
I'm
places.
Still on the road, however.
Okay, so we best wrap this up. Thank you very much for listening. Remember, if you have enjoyed, please do like and subscribe. We do need those subscriptions. Otherwise, we have to keep bringing James in on these podcasts.
And I get fired, so please subscribe.
I might get invited again.
Keep your eyes peeled on our social media. Of course, so upcoming is the Bicester auction, so cars will be online. They'll also be on our Instagram accounts. You'll be able to see them as we consign them. So that's a lot of fun. And we'll be back on a podcast at Bicester. I'm hoping Haggerty will have us in their little clubhouse. That would be fun.
Fingers crossed.
And possibly with Vicky if she's back off her holidays, if she ever wants to come back again.
I saw her at Goodwood the other day.
Well, maybe she's just lying to us and she's not here at all. So for all the other details, any lot list details, please go to the website, historics.co.uk. We'll see you very soon. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.